Welcome to the Hacktivist Podcast.
And welcome to another episode of the Hacktivist Podcast. My name is Ajijo Kwabna Intubuisiako. And I'm joined today by
David Adoration.
Nice. So David, let's just dive right in. Did you grow up in Ghana?
Partially, yes.
Yes. How was it like?
It was great.
Was it like, was it post Nkrumah?
Yeah, I was born in 1958. Came to Ghana, well, in Australia. Came to Ghana in 66 or so. So Nkrumah was overthrown in 67, I think.
Ooh.
So, yeah, my awareness is post Nkrumah.
Post Nkrumah.
Okay. By the time we came, I mean, I was young, I didn't appreciate it.
Much of what?
Yeah, but I knew that I had been a cook, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Then it changed. Mm-hmm. And what was it like, at least having the perspective of being in Australia and in Ghana? Or that memory is a bit vague?
No, it's not actually. I mean, at the time, Ghana was very, well, transitionally in terms of comforts, etc. Ghana was great. We were integrated. Our school was very international. It was not a huge generational situational jump in terms of quality of life or anything. In fact, life was better here. And a bigger house and all that. So yeah, it wasn't a huge difference. I was still surrounded by white people.
At the time?
In Ghana, yeah. Definitely. My class, all teachers were white. Everybody was white. Friends were white. Around us, a few Ghanaians in the school, but the transition wasn't huge. You know,
oh, okay.
Initially. And then we went to Kumasi in 67. And then, yeah, it was coming to Ghana, but I was taken. Again. Comfort-wise, Ghana was pretty good. They still delivered milk to our house. It was nice. It was okay.
Wow. Okay, so if I understand, your level, there is a bit of privilege in how you grew up.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, good. So you in tech, right?
Yeah, from 67.
From 67. How was the politics like, the student politics like?
No idea. I was in primary school.
Oh!
No idea.
Tech primary,
yes.
Yeah.
We were not really, at least personally, I was not aware of or tuned into politics. So very little impact on your life at that point, at that age. Yeah. 67, I was 9.
Yeah.
What does that mean? And what do you care about politics? We were under who? 69, thereabouts, who was ruling? This was busiest time, busiest time. So no, it wasn't high impact on me.
On you.
The first thing you see about politics was maybe from the 70s, you know, in secondary school, and soldiers had taken over. So you knew that there'd been a coup. All of a sudden, just commanded this, commanded that, Operation Feed Yourself. Then you felt a bit of impact of military rule. But in terms of an impact on my life, in terms of becoming radicalized, socialized, or aware, not at that point.
Not at that point. Did I run all the way to university or so?
Yeah, maybe university. University is where you became more aware, because university was thrown into a period of social unrest in Ghana, when people were agitating for a change in government. The students were continuously at odds with government, so they want to issue another. So yes, at that point become socially aware. Then I was in the law faculty, which at the time was very conscious. Of people who were doing law were very conscious of politics and you know, we're all live to social differences. We're all getting inculcated left-wing politics, all believing, we're all becoming socialists and believers. You know, I think it's a phase everybody passes through. You should become aware, you should be worried about society. My awareness was created around there,
Around the 70s, 80s?
Yes. Whilst I was in university, definitely.
And also because you were in the law faculty?
I think so. You know, a lot of the political leaders you see around today, your Church of Chickadees, Principal J, everybody, who are our lecturers and our friends, were living with them, hanging with them, smoking together, doing all sorts of things. Our friends. So yes, a lot of that rubbed off me.
And did any of that, how was the atmosphere like? Was there a lot more people willing to force change? Or
Students were very, very, very the student movement was a very powerful force for change in society at the time. You had the professional groups, you had students pushing hard for change, and you had the military government responding brutally. So yes, there were strong forces for change in the university, and the university was the hotbed of politics in Ghana, if you're aware, you know, the coup. Jerry Rawlings' school was sort of fostered from campus, from people I knew, you know. And a lot of people I knew got very closely involved in the government when they did do the coup. But even in the run-up to the second one, certainly, he was on campus all the time. We all knew him, spoke together.
We'll come to the present so that we can see the contrast. But do you think that there was a particular condition around that time that created that awareness, that forced people to think about change, about taking their destinies into their own hands?
I think very clearly, economic pressures, as always, were the main driving force. Ghana was going through some really tough economic times. People were leaving the country with jobs, with food, farming. And so that, I think, really pushed people to see change. At the same time, some people were getting very, very rich and had been under the military governments. You know, they're very simplistic solutions to economic problems. Get import license, you're a rich man. And that's all about knowing somebody in the right place, that culture of patronization, and thing that's building hasn't changed. And I think, you know, those social, well, economic pressures were telling and pushing social fabric, tearing the world.
And the consequences of all the social pressures accumulated in the Rawlings regime.
If you listen to Rawlings, yes. Rawlings has a very good account of it, saying that there were so many social pressures, blah, blah, blah. I agree with him to a large extent that those pressures were real and they were there. Others feel he was just an opportunist. I disagree with that. I don't think he was an opportunist. What he has become today is another matter. What he became is another matter. But at the time, certainly, maybe naively, he sought to great change. Mm-hmm. Yes. I think he's a creation of the times. And if he hasn't been wrong, he's been somebody else.
Yeah. Most definitely would have been somebody else if he hadn't been Rollins. Because the pot was brewing, if I understand.
Yeah. I think so.
Yeah. And in your opinion, right, the kind of change that came because of that period, was that the best case scenario?
Yeah, those things are, you see what, answer is 2020 vision.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer to that, with the benefit of hindsight, has to be no.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, you know, I got caught up by everybody. Young students, this change, you know, socialist background. At the same time, there were atrocities associated with what was going on, which was certainly a downside. People have personal stories to tell, which were not pleasant. I lost family, we executed.
Wow.
In this.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that was downside, but I was in a bit of a dilemma. My uncle had just been executed, but ideologically, I thought this change was necessary. But it's hard to say. I think a change was necessary. I do think so. I think we had, as a society, developed some really unfortunate economic structures which could not be allowed to continue. Inefficiency, the corruption, blah, blah, blah. But I ask you, has corruption changed?
No.
They're just going to be happy with that.
Mm. So you're a socialist?
Am I?
Yeah.
It's a question I've been asking myself a lot. I believe that in a society like this, there's insufficient education, insufficient information, and insufficient communication to allow market forces to dictate things. Because that model of government works where the market can react to information, to news. It reacts and corrects. And then that is classic capitalism.
Yeah.
And that's the factors of production will move in the most efficient manner. I do think that in Ghana or in the third world, we are not able to, and that the role of government has to be part to a large extent. I do think that, like I say, the capitalist system will not work at this stage of our world. I do think, and I do think socialism in the pure sense, in the sense of being pro the proletariat against the ruling class, the masses, is a reflection of an earlier society. It's a response to England and the class system. It's a response to the Russian ruling class against the peasantry, etc. I think that a society like ours gives more opportunity, or is more fluid, and that those class distinctions that define socialism are not as rigid as what Lenin and Marx responded to, right? So for that reason, I'm reluctant to be pigeonholed like that. But I do think we need a society which is more cognitive of the need to support less privileged, yes, and more gives more recognition to the fact that wealth must be created from the bottom up. And that trickle-down wealth theory, which is espoused by Trump, increasingly our MPP, I don't see it working. This too is suffering too much going on to espouse. I was in an interesting conversation last night with some politicians talking about the ethos of the MPP and its history. And we were talking about aspiration. And that, they think that they want to create a system where there's opportunity for people to rise, and people should aspire to wealth and power. And what they should do is support some people to achieve that so that they can pull their society up. Mm-hmm. Sounds nice. And maybe it could work. They will claim that this happened in Korea and other countries, South Korea. And that America, for example, was built by people amassing wealth, creating, concentrating capital, and therefore pulling others along with them, creating jobs. And that's true. That's what happened. But there's a lot of misery which comes along with that. And I would like, I would advocate a system which is more efficient than this socialist thing, because it is important to create wealth, and if it is an aggregation of capital, that is the only way to write, so be it. But it must have built-in systems to support the people who really generate the wealth, you know, the workers, the farmers, the fishermen. Yeah. We can't use them, we use them.
So more of possibly what is termed social democracy?
I would be closer to that, I think.
Okay. There are more social nets and
networks and supports.
And supports and all of that. Okay, that's interesting. That thought has developed over time, right? And was there growing up or in the university an atmosphere where people are allowed to develop such ideas and such thoughts?
Oh, certainly. They were in the 80s, when I was there, 70s, 80s, yeah, very definitely.
So there were like clubs, there were...
clubs. Groupings. I mean, I'm not somebody who does clubs. I don't do associations, I don't do clubs.
Yeah.
So even if those are socialists, I wouldn't have one. You know, but yes, you gravitate towards people, like-minded people, yes. But so there was a lot of, that.
And the idea of free thinking was encouraged?
Absolutely.
Okay. Do you see a change in that? So we can start moving towards the 90s and the 2000s.
I don't know enough about how young people deal. Except maybe my people here. But from a distance, what I observe, at least at the university level, what worries me is religion. Too much of it. And I think religion is a mental cloister. It locks your mind. And I see, I go to Legon, I haven't been there for years, but a few times I've been there, and people chanting on the fields and doing. I think it's very worrying about this evangelism that has swept the universities. I hear a lot of it, when I do talk to some of their friends. It's a matter of concern to me. I think you should. You can be religious, but you should. Any religion which doesn't allow you to think is a problem. Strange jackets, I've got a problem with it. And that's one thing I've seen about students these days. I also see, I don't see the university as a social force anymore. I mean, now you have what's the name of Brothers Group, this social pressure group,
you can occupy Ghana.
You see them, and they're doing a good job, I think. But the universities, which used to be the driving force, that kind of protest, they're silent. Have you seen any university protests now?
Nothing.
Nothing comes out of that type comes out of universities now. They are silent. You wonder if they are not thinking, or there's no anger, or they're being silent somehow. I don't know.
I'll show you the anger is there.
Yeah?
The anger is there. So, Free Thinking Campus, I wanted to start something like, because I realized the past universities were hub of free thinking and change. So I went there and we did a walkthrough. So we were knocking on doors. We knocked on over almost 200 doors and spoke to students. The anger is there, but then there's a lot of apathy too, because to them, no matter how angry they are, there's not going to be any change. So I think the problem is an apathy now. And with the religiosity too, yes, 200 doors, 190 of them, people were actually praying or listening to gospel music. And some of them will actually let you know that, look, I'm not ready to listen now because I'm actually going to church, or I just came back from church, I'm too tired, or I'm about to pray.
It's amazing to me. I mean, yeah. I just don't see how you can be that way at that age.
Yeah.
You should be questioning. Not swallowing dogma.
It's the apathy, and I'll come to that. Maybe you can help us solve that problem.
I don't know.
Yeah, because the apathy stems from too many times that they've been failed,
maybe,
by the system, and so they go to someone else, or they go to another system, which is dogma, because that is more reliable and has more traditions and stuff like that.
Maybe.
So they are switching from.
I can understand. I've become very cynical about party politics in Ghana.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knows that I'm intolerant of MPP.
This is the hack.
Oh, there's a bunch of people.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make me very popular. But, and it's probably born of the same. I've seen them all come. Spouting promises. So when people can say, well, MPP is better than MPP, like, what's the difference? What really? What do you people see? They're all things.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see a difference.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking to a politician last night, high ranking MPP. His thoughts is that even though a lot has remains the same, he thinks the MPP are better economic managers or managers of the economy. And between current government and Mahama, I would agree.
Mm-hmm.
Between, but I mean, if you overlook the work that Kwesi Boteyeko did between 83 and 92, then you are missing the point, because they did a great job of stabilizing this economy, because we're on our knees.
Yeah.
And it's only people who haven't got a good recollection of history, which is a common thing, who will say that these guys are necessarily better economic managers. I don't know if that's the case.
I think we are not playing the politics of lesser devils.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
when they were there, they did this, and
exactly. And that culture, I don't know exactly when that started.
I don't know, but it's heading towards increased mediocrity.
Yes. And it's a problem, but there needs to be a way that we can solve it. We can look to the past, realize how it started, let people know how it started, and then find a way to stop it. Because right now we are spiraling towards chaos.
Mm.
We are almost there. And if you look at the economic indicators and all of the good info, the proper data out there, we shouldn't be proud of our short-term gains.
And you point to little things. Ghana has learned something the other day.
Yeah.
Look around you.
Yeah.
Me. What's my major?
Mm-hmm.
It is people who ask me for money.
Mm-hmm.
And I have never been under so much pressure as I am these days.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot spend a day where at least 3 loan applications.
Mm-hmm.
Give me a loan. Help me do this. Help me do that. in trying to help. But clearly, one of two things, either now people think I have money, or people have real problems and are telling to one of the two.
Mm-hmm.
Not from thinking I have money, that one, they probably thought it for a long time, and you know why they weren't coming there. But now, it's terrible.
Mm-hmm.
It is really bad. Every day, I will have to do something. Some problem. Today I've paid for a funeral. Somebody's wife is there. It's the hospital. Somebody's wife. Every day I do something.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very real test and barometer. People are just not able to make ends meet.
Mm. There are clearly no social net.
There's no social net. There's nothing for them.
Mm.
The second funeral I've done is here for people. No, the other one's in December. You can't afford.
You can't afford to bury
their wife. Both of them, their wives. And where? It's sad.
Wow. So let's look to the future. What do you think? Because I clearly understand that Ghana's past is sketchy. We had 20 years of just chaos.
I think so.
And then we had another subsequent 20 years of plateauing. And the Fourth Republic has been a total disappointment.
Yes, I would agree.
Now, we have to look past.
What is going to change Ghana?
Yes.
I'm very, very hopeful. I like a lot of my colleagues and age mates. I see a generational shift.
Mm-hmm.
You see, I think a large part of our problem is our inability to question culture. If somebody knows something wrong, is your boss, you can see it. If you disagree, you have a different idea because the leadership is going to say you don't can't speak up, you don't do anything, you know. And it's cultural.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't brought up that way. I grew up abroad, and my parents were very well educated.
Mm-hmm.
So my father encouraged speaking up.
Mm-hmm.
That all. He didn't try. Suppress us. My father, well, of course, to some extent, like any adults, we try, we operate from the premise that we are wiser than. But I'm not. You see? But I tolerate. You can say anything you like, can't you? And I think that it's also. What's the word? That attitude is fortified by. The attitudes of our children who have come back from educations abroad, particularly those people who return from America, this kind of people, they don't take dogma, accept dogma easy. And they want to know why. And they want to know how. And for that reason, children or your generation are more likely to set up businesses. They don't want to go and work in the civil service. They want to do things for themselves. They are more adventurous and they question more. And I think that is the only thing that's going to save Ghana. That mindset will change Ghana. Because those people there, look, I can sit in this house and say, you know what, you guys, if Ghana's going to be good, you all good MPP or NDC. And they will do it. I could do that. and they will do it, even though I'm not in the ballot box with them. And Ghana is full of people like that. They can be influenced like sheep. Yeah. But if I tell Frimpoma to go and vote NDC, she won't wait to go in the ballot box before telling me. She doesn't think she's going to do that. She'll do this or that or that. I can't control that. I can argue with her, try and persuade her, but not much more. But in the past, that was easily done. And you still get a lot of people saying, "My papa, now you're MPP, like it's a tradition, can't you think? You know, if this, the political and social realities are facing, can't you think about that and see what suits you? No, you know, they won't do that.
And I think the political class knows this and is taking advantage of it, because we still have institutions like chieftaincy.
Ah, those people too.
We still have institutions like chieftaincy, and then this whole idea of top-down approach. So everybody who wants to be anybody is craving for either a title. It's craving for a title of any kind, just so they can say, "Do you know who I am?" and prevent any further dialogue, because they realize that dialogue kind of takes away or diffuses power, and being able to challenge and then ask questions diffuses power, and they don't want that because they wouldn't have power.
Look, when I always say this, there's a certain critical mass being built in our society of young people who will not take rubbish. We will not just swallow this garbage that people spread out. And that is when that will change. I don't think it's going to be a revolution. I don't know. Maybe we could get some inspirational leader. I don't know. But I think it will be a gradual process. If this wouldn't destroy it before then, that is what happened. Then we will lift ourselves. I'm hopeful. I'm optimistic.
Yeah, that's the I mean, what's the word if you are pessimistic? It just takes too much energy.
Well, no, it can be very, sometimes you're being realistic. You can see the house is burning. You know, you're being optimistic about it. It's burning.
Yeah. But then also, right, looking at the conditions of the past where it was difficult, and therefore it forced people to think, right? Many of the opinion that we need to create the atmosphere, that particular atmosphere again, and that for some, you should allow the system to devolve until it gets to the point where the critical mass of people realize. That's classic anarchism.
I'm out of the system collapsing.
Yeah, so it can build itself again.
I think social costs are too high. I think the suffering that you are going to reach become even more extreme. And I think anarchism is a short-term solution. And maybe, yes, a stronger society will emerge, but it's just a way of accelerating the process. And so you have to decide which course is that cost you get to it, and that's the problem. Because we always say the countries which have had a long history of war and privation, they developed stronger societies. It's there, the examples are there for you to see. And the South Africans,
Rwanda,
but do you need to do that? I mean, isn't history about learning from mistakes? Isn't it possible to study some of these achievements and learn and do that? Do you have to go through the same process?
Unfortunately, right, it brings me to the point I was trying to, about how intentional the political class is being, because for a while history was taken out of our curriculum. So I, for instance, didn't do history. So
At any point.
So my interest in history is intentional. Like, I'm trying to understand.
Did you tell your children this must be horrifying? Get help.
Yeah, so I feel like there's an intentional, there are intentional instruments around to prevent us from, you know, at least questioning the system.
You know, you touch on something, and that's conspiracy theories.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure there's some room somewhere where people are plotting this kind of strategic directions for the political class.
Mm-hmm.
You give them too much credit. They are not doing anything like that. They have, in my opinion, I mean, just a function of short-sightedness, a function of a lack of education.
Mm-hmm.
They themselves, let me say that, educated. What about university graduates? They have no intellectual capacity.
None.
They come and parrot things that they don't think through things. I think somebody will sit there, so we don't need history. After all, what do you do history? Teach you, go in there, and then they say, okay, we can cut history and literature
and visual
out of the curriculum because we don't have money. Let's focus on creating people who can work or technical skills. And that argument wins the day. And then you have this kind of short-sighted view of education.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. Those things will happen.
Mm-hmm.
And they're happening everywhere. But there should be, in a free society, there will be little islands of quality and excellence. Because nobody can sit, get up and say, every school in Ghana must do this.
Mm-hmm.
Or, in America, yes, they have. America is one of the worst elementary school systems in the world. I mean, all those kids go there and shoot them each other. Mm-hmm. And, it's terrible. But they're beacons of excellence. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's no better place than getting
postgraduate.
Mm-hmm. But when we are all bricks in the wall, and that's a problem socialism is. Or communism, as opposed to socialism. We all become rich in the world, we all win, China Mao's something.
Yeah, that becomes.
Ideas don't flourish.
Yeah. So there needs to be like a balance.
Exactly, that's where. Like that's where.
Yeah. And I agree, like, I have been there also where I understand, like, the extremes don't work. But then the balance always works. And my engineering background always tells me a hybrid system solves the problem that neither fully electric or fully, you always find that balance and you just go with it. Okay, awesome. So you still have hope, but then you're still worried about
the direction.
The religiosity greatly affects the free thinking. And we still don't have like free thinking spaces on campuses.
Yeah. Which should be, I mean, a campus should be that.
Yeah.
A campus is not building. It is an exchange of ideas.
Yeah.
And once that ceases, then that location is no longer a university. In my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. And even the culture on campuses now where you cannot question your lecturer. Yeah, it's to me, the only, for instance, in my university education, the only lecturers that I could question were lecturers who were actually visiting lecturers.
Okay. Where do you go? Tech?
Tech.
Well, Tech has had a history of not questioning for a long time. Because of the nature, it's engineering.
Yeah.
It's left or right. It's not.
But it's 90% art, 10% science.
Well,
so we should be able
if you have that view, you're a heretic.
I'm one of the few people who actually think Elon Musk's new pickup truck design is actually revolutionary.
I've seen that.
But my fellow engineers are like, no, the truck is supposed to look like this. I'm like, the truck looks like that only because of the Romans and then their carriage design. So
it should be you guys around function rather than
history. Anyways. So we have that top down, and I feel like maybe we should start from the home, because that whole top down approach, as you said, in your house is almost democratized.
Where... Unfortunately, I'm trying to.
There's no going back. There's
still some discipline. I'm trying to talk, but no response.
There's no going back. Once we taste democracy, we don't go back. So yeah, I mean, so democratizing from the home setting, and then from into the school.
But it's very difficult.
It's extremely difficult
for people to let go of that kind of control. Mm-hmm. I'm only this way because my father was that way. Mm-hmm. He was intellectual, so he left our school. Mm-hmm. But very few people I know grew up that way. We lived on the university campus. Mm-hmm. Around us, mm-hmm. it was the same. Mm-hmm. A lot of like-minded mm-hmm. families were. Mm-hmm. It was normal, our culture. But it's not usual. And my generation, unfortunately, hasn't changed.
Mm-hmm. You think it's possible to socially engineer?
I don't know.
Ghana for to become like that, where it's more democratized.
I think that takes like, the only way to achieve that would be to get an inspirational leader. Mm. But that's not something that you can engineer.
You know,
yeah. Those people come by providence. Yeah. And a strong man who has a real vision and who can actually change the way people think is. Yeah. Have you watched Messiah? Yeah. I recommend it.
On Netflix.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You watched it.
Yeah, I started watching it, but it got confusing.
Because you're asking a lot of questions.
Yeah.
I think it's brilliant. Mm. I think it's brilliant. I'm waiting for more. You know, if Jesus was to come today, how would he
respond?
That's the thesis.
Yeah.
And the responses I'm seeing, they're very plausible.
Yeah.
People say, some Arab somewhere, where should we be? Mm-hmm. Is he a Shiite? Is he a this? Is he a such? Mm-hmm. That's how the Romans saw it. Mm-hmm. And Chuchi, that's what he did his long essay in university on mm-hmm. Jesus as a factor of social engineering. Mm-hmm. And then you stop him.
The archetype is very important to socialism, mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. Jesus archetype. Yeah, because he wasn't just coming as the Messiah, he was coming to let you liberate yourself. And that's important to social change.
Yeah. That's the kind of change that leader I'm thinking about.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily have to be divine
yeah.
to achieve that, but it helps.
I mean, it helps a lot given how stubborn humans
are. Yeah, yeah.
So if you have a few tricks up your sleeve, yeah, that would
work on some water.
Yeah, and then just get people to just shut up and listen.
Okay.
This has been a lovely conversation.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this. We'll probably do this another time.
Sure.
Maybe talk about politics some more. Trying to understand. Again, I'm pretty confused as to why the 80s did not bring... Because the 80s were prime for change, for Ghana to be totally different. And I'm still wondering what went wrong, whether people did not have followed through, because everything was prime. The leaders were, like the leadership at that time, Rollins in his prime was charisma. He had the charisma. The people themselves.
And that is why he holds the most responsibility for our failures.
Yes.
Because he had the greatest opportunity.
Exactly.
And he threw it away.
So I want to, I'm trying to find out what happened and what made him throw it away.
Why was he unable to change?
Why was he unable to do
a lack of drive from him?
Or was he betrayed? I'm trying to understand what happened, because
that would be interesting.
It was clear that if Ghana was gonna, I don't think we're gonna have that opportunity again.
Unless
there's another revolution. But then that particular revolution
was it a revolution really?
It wasn't. Yeah. The people themselves wanted change, and then Rollins appeared and it was going to be that whole topsy-turvy of power structures all coming down, and then we were going to rebuild. And then all of a sudden, everything...
Business as usual.
Everything went back to business. So I'm trying to see whether there were... He gave up on the vision.
Was compromised.
Like, what happened that ruined a decade? There was a decade that...
Opportunity for change, yeah. Was it the right kind of change? I don't know. Yeah, there's, and I was listening to that music. I was shocked to see. But they don't think the same way. So.
They don't come with your tradition before?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. And they don't. From the way I understand it, their vision is a bit more right center than
right no sentence, right?
It's fully right than what Ghana had hoped for at that time.
Yeah, but you see, I think it's always important to try to understand the other perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Like I say, I'm situated somewhere in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
I believe in capitalism as a force for economic growth,
mm-hmm.
but I think it has to be limited. So there are certain things that we do which make sense. But you see, this Dankwa Bosia tradition or this Nkrumah tradition, fact, the people who are espousing those traditions are holding, they have no ideology.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask the NPP man, what's the ideology of your party? There's nothing to say. Ask the NDC man. They have nothing. They don't know anything. They have not even developed internally a reason why they adhere to this party. The reasons they do are different from what they ought to be. They are just saying, this one's an Akram party, or this one's house owning democracy, or.
Mm-hmm.
In their business for something, these people we are oppressed, or these ruling classes are cheating us, or NDC people, you know, we sit down and things.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about how society is structured for a vast majority of these people.
Mm-hmm.
They do not even think about it. And that's a problem for me. That's why I cannot ascribe to any party.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what do they sound? They don't even know themselves. So I should go and go. No, I won't go to them. But I won't go to them. Yeah.
You think if we bring civics, there used to be civics.
Yeah.
You think if we bring civics back to as young as, say, primary school, to start the whole process to understand, because a lot of people don't understand what government is, and people still think that government is different from the people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's something we should be learning. I mean, if people actually learn anything in school, I don't know if they do. But yes, it's a discussion because, to put it brutally, we aren't civilized.
Mm-hmm.
Civilization is about individuals living in communities and working together and making accommodations and adjustments so that we can create wealth and health and safety for us as a community. That's civilization. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I was building a house in Sheba. No power, no gutters. I bought electricity there, in charge of anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't know how to use it. I said, let's do gutters, but I won't do what I did with electricity. Mm-hmm. I'll do my own, everybody should do. So we can all drain our house. We won't do it. And that's no civilization.
Mm-hmm.
They think, but meanwhile, you go and buy a Range Rover,
yeah,
or a bench or something. Then you drive it on that rubbish road. But let's get together and pull our resources and do something. And we see ourselves as well.
Mm-hmm.
It can work together.
Yeah. One of the themes we are exploring in humanism, right, is African humanism and how it started, right? So for us, we see our humanism to be more of Ubuntuism, where we are because, I am because we are. So it's more of, what's the word, more community-based, more communal. Because that's, like, if you look at history, that's what it was all
I'm
about.
I'm not like that at all.
Yeah. Yeah, it's more communal.
Yeah, like, I know.
You look out for one another, you come together.
Yeah,
and then you
come in this society, in the urban.
So the question is, what happened? And the question also is, when did it go?
I think it worked better or it worked better when we were more agrarian societies, mm-hmm. and we relied on each other for labor,
mm-hmm.
and to aggregate crops.
Mm-hmm.
But when you shift into an urban space, mm-hmm. your needs are different. You mm-hmm. don't need four wives because your job is not about farming a large tract of land, mm-hmm. so you need a big family to get a family. Mm-hmm. So you change. One wife mm-hmm. is more than enough.
Yeah.
Continue. So it changes your society mm-hmm. changes with your economics.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect that the change in the economic survival
mm-hmm.
roots is what has changed mm-hmm. our societal
mm-hmm. And we still need communal spaces. We still need hospitals.
But we do live. I'm living next door to these people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
we must find a way of coexisting.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And do you think this is something that can be taught and it's
I think sometimes when you teach people, they recognize things or are able to better articulate in their minds things that they already see.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, yes. Mm-hmm. You won't teach somebody to love his brother.
Mm-hmm.
And when you see Jesus says, love your brother, he is not saying love him. You say, appreciate his needs,
mm-hmm.
factor them into what you do,
mm-hmm.
so that we all can practice the social.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you're saying. I'm not sure something has learned, but if you are taught, you will recognize
mm-hmm.
that your actions, how your actions impact
mm-hmm.
on others, and the results that will ensue if nobody mm-hmm. convinces anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, I agree, you can be taught.
Mm-hmm.
You can learn. And so that we need to have it articulated for ourselves to see it. It's in us that we need to be taught.
Mm-hmm. So there's hope. We can socially engineer the country.
There's hope, but it's the young people.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, young people listening, the older generation have hope in us also. It's the ball is in our court. So all right, it's been lovely talking to you. We'll do this again. Thank you all for listening. As always, think for yourself and care for others.
Yep. Yeah.
This is good.
This has been the Hacktivist Podcast. As always, think for yourself and care for others.